17 seconds and counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2.
Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are willing to control, and one we intend to win.
Okay, engine stop. AJ at a descent. Hold control mode, auto descent, engine command override off. Engine arm on. 413 is in.
We stop to get down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
April 13th, 2015 will be the 45th anniversary of the explosion on Apollo 13. The explosion that scrubbed the moon landing and challenged everyone involved in the mission to safely bring the Apollo 13 astronauts back home. Next on Cosmic Perspective, my guest will be Apollo 13 Lunar Module pilot Fred Hayes. Today's guest was a Marine Corps fighter pilot. He completed his graduate work at the Aerospace Research Pilot School at Edwards Air Force Base, where he was a test pilot, a veteran of space shuttle approach and landing tests, and one of only 24 humans to go to the moon and back as lunar module pilot of Apollo 13. Mr. Fred Hayes, it's an honor to have you with us today.
Glad to join you, Andy.
Mr. Hayes, you were a test pilot for many years. How did you become interested in flying?
I became interested in flying because I wanted to serve my country during the Korean War. And at the being 18 years of age with 2 years of college, the only program I could get into that led to a commission, which was really my primary goal because I had never flown in my life, was the Naval Aviation Cadet Program. And, of course, as it turned out, I immediately knew when I first started flying that I really loved and I was going to make a career of it. And that, of course, led me down the trail that eventually led me to be an astronaut.
How did you get involved with the space program?
I was a NASA test pilot. Okay. I was with NASA. I basically followed Neil Armstrong's path. I was 2.5 years behind Neil. We both started with NASA at the Lewis Research Center in Cleveland, Ohio, now Glenn. And we both later transferred to Flight Research Center at Edwards, which became Dryden after we went through and now has become Neil, A. Armstrong Flight Research Center. And then we both went into the astronaut program.
Apollo 13 was your first and only flight into space. Would you explain to our listeners the experience of launching on the most powerful rocket to launch humans into space at the time, the Saturn V rocket?
The Saturn V, even though obviously it's impressive in its size, and for people who observe launches, and I have other than Apollo 13, it makes a lot of noise, very impressive. The ride itself, for most of all of us in that day and age, we were all pilots had been in the military. I'd been in two Marine fighter squadrons earlier. It wasn't that difficult a ride. We were laying on couches rather than sitting upright in an ejection seat, which you are normally in a fighter airplane. G levels and doing combat air combat maneuvering, even in the fighters of that day and age a while back, you would pull 6 or 7 Gs. And today's fighters, of course, they're pulling up 8 or 9 Gs. And the rocket ride, the biggest, highest level of Gs was 4.5. So it was less in that respect. Probably the most unusual thing about the ride was the, it was pretty herky-jerky. It was not a, this was before good digital systems we had today. And it was pretty, when the engines gimbaled down below, way below us to steer the rocket, that was exaggerated up in the capsule. So you got a lot of jerky motion, particularly left-right was unusual compared to an airplane. But that was about it. The most wondrous other thing was when it finally arced on over to get that view of the Earth horizon as you were going up through probably about 60 miles at that point.
After liftoff, what are the next steps required to get the spacecraft in position to go to the moon?
The way the mission went, you went around Earth orbit a couple of times. The third stage was reignited by people on the ground in mission control. And that accelerated you to escape velocity to head to the moon. The lunar module, which was covered throughout launch by panels, those were shed. And Jack Schweigert separated our mothership, our command and service module, and went out a couple of hundred feet and turned around, pitched around, and came back in and inserted a probe into the upper hatch of the drogue in the lunar module that then latches could be fired that pulled the two vehicles tightly together to have an airtight seal that later you could open up the hatches and be able to go through a tunnel between the two spacecraft.
I see. So now your mission consists of the lunar module, the command module, and the service module connected together. Basically.
That's correct. Yeah. And the lunar module still is, in essence, not powered up. It received some minimal power for certain critical heaters in the craft from the command and service module. We hooked up an umbilical in the tunnel after we got them connected that provided a little minimum power that way.
Things went relatively smoothly for Apollo 13 until a little more than 2 days into the mission after you had a live TV transmission back to the Earth. But the major networks did not pick up the transmission.
Right? That's correct. We did a... Actually, I sort of scripted it out roughly with more a show-and-tell type thing. We picked certain equipment that we knew might be interesting to talk about and had pulled that out to do that. That was the TV show, was to describe this equipment and how we would use it later. And you're right, it was not carried by the any of the primary newscasts.
Right after the TV transmission back to Earth, there was a mission task that was required.
There was a call to stir the cryos, they call it. There's a little, sort of like a little egg beater in the cryogenic tanks, oxygen and hydrogen. And they were occasionally asked to be stirred, which gave them better quantity readings because the very cold fluids in there tended to stratify in zero gravity, and by mixing them up, they could get better quantity readings. So Jim and I were not in the command module at the time, but Jack Swigert was still there, and he threw the switch, which caused an electric short in that tank, and it's eventually overpressurized. Temperature went up, and it exploded, and ended up blowing off one whole panel off the service module.
And that's when the famous words were spoken.
Yeah, Jack made a call, Houston, we've had a problem. And by the shortly after that, Jim Lovell had gotten back in position and actually put his radio headset on and repeated the call because Houston had not answered at that time.
What was the physical experience you felt, and what was going through your mind about what happened during this explosion?
There was nothing going through my mind except everybody except confusion. You it was not very clear from any of the instrumentation or the caution warning as to specifically what had happened or why it had happened. In fact, in truth, that was never found out till after the flight when they did a lot of data analysis. But in any case, the one thing that was for sure when I got back into my normal position in the command module in the right-hand couch in front of me, and that was my main duties, was to take care of the electrical system, some of the environmental controls, all the cryogenics, fuel cells, that sort of thing. And it was apparent from looking at the panel very quickly, realized that tank two, oxygen tank two, was gone. Several meters were indicating at the bottom of their gauges, which for sure meant that, you know, there were different instrumentation. So it really meant for sure the tank was gone.
Is that at the point when you realized that the mission for landing on the moon would be aborted?
Yes, I knew that. So within the first minute, I knew we had lost the landing. In fact, we wouldn't be able to go in the lunar orbit. And I just had a sick feeling in the pit of my stomach. I was for disappointment because I knew we had lost the mission at that point. We still wasn't life-threatening because it appeared that we still had the second tank one was intact. And if that was the case, we would have been able to stay fully powered up and just had to abort.
Once you realized that the landing on the moon mission wasn't possible, what was the plan to get you all back safely to Earth?
Well, the normal plan was you would use that normal rocket engine on the service module, and mission control would have normally given us maneuvers that could have either brought us back directly, or we could have ended up going around the moon as we had. So, you know, because normal plan, when you lose a critical element of any one of the systems, the plan is come home as soon as possible. Of course, what happened here was we ended up losing the second oxygen tank and ended up ultimately shutting down the command and service module completely, which was never planned. And so to answer your question, for that situation, there was no plan.
Now that the second oxygen tank was depleted, you had no choice but to shut down the command module.
Yeah, there was no choice. The command module got to a point where they worried we were depleting the batteries, the small batteries needed for entry. So it had to be shut down.
So you powered down the command module and moved into the lunar module, which basically became your lifeboat.
Yeah, it was our living quarters and everything quarters, yeah.
Was it at that point that it was decided to slingshot around the moon to return to the Earth?
Yeah, mission control, I assume, talked about it shortly. As I understand, they didn't talk about it very long. They were worried about to come directly back. They would have had to use the engine on the service module and almost all the fuel. And they just thought it was too risky because they didn't know the condition overall of the vehicle and even that propulsion system. So it didn't take them long to figure out that we were going to have to go around the moon.
While you were in the lunar module, you had plenty of oxygen, but there was a problem with the lithium hydroxide cartridges.
The lithium hydroxide cartridges were used to cleanse carbon dioxide from the air. When you're in a submarine or a closed spacecraft, a closed compartment, as you're breathing in, your body consumes the oxygen through your lungs. But every time you breathe out carbon dioxide. So if you're in a closed room or a closed, like I said, a submarine or a spacecraft, eventually the carbon dioxide builds up to a dangerous level. So you have to have a way of getting rid of it. And the lithium cartridges was the way it was done. Environmental system forced the air to go through these cartridges, and that captured the carbon dioxide. The problem was the lunar module had a different shaped cartridge for its environmental system, but also didn't have enough of them, enough spares. And the command module ones were a different size and shape. So there was a little workaround they figured out to let us use the command module cartridges, and there were abundance of them, hooking them up to an intake hose into the environmental system in a limb, using backs and fronts of checklists, stiff cardboard, gray tape, and a couple of socks to stuff a hole in the cartridge. And that way the air got pulled through that square cartridge that, again, did the job.
The crew of Apollo 13 used duct tape, cardboard, and socks as one of their workarounds to keep the levels of carbon dioxide low enough to eventually return them to the command module. Not such a big deal for Apollo Lunar Module pilot Fred Hayes. By the way, if you're superstitious, Apollo 13 launched on April 11th, 1970, at 13:13 Central Time. That's the time that Mission Control uses for all their missions. And the explosion in Apollo 13's service module occurred on April 13th Central Time. We'll be back with Apollo 13 Lunar Module pilot Fred Hayes to discuss crowded conditions and extremely cold temperatures in the Lunar Module, restarting the command module's electrical system, which had never been attempted before, and positioning and preparing the command module for a safe landing.
This is the crew of Apollo 13, wishing everybody there a nice evening, and we're just about ready to close out our inspection of Aquarius and get back for a pleasant evening and Odyssey. Good night.
13, we've got one more item for you when you get a chance. We'd like it to stir up your cryo tanks. In addition, I have a shaft and trunnion.
Okay.
For a look at the Comet Bennett if you need it.
Okay. Stand by. Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem. We've had a main beam bus undervolt.
Roger, main beam undervolt. Okay, stand by, 13. We're looking at it.
Next is the conclusion of my interview with Apollo 13 Lunar Module pilot Fred Hayes. What was the temperature like in the Lunar Module?
The temperature got down very chilly because it was a vehicle that was meant to operate for 2 days. You know, you land on the moon, you do a couple of BVAs, and then you come back out and rendezvous. And we now are in a position where it had to last 4 days, roughly double its lifetime. So we had to severely power it down. A lot of equipment wasn't on, which is what generates a lot of the heat. And as a result, without that much heat being generated, even from our bodies, the vehicle wasn't designed to operate at that low a power level, and so it gradually crept up to a stabilized temperature based on the amount of thermal blankets on the vehicle that got to probably in the mid-30s Fahrenheit.
Very cold temperatures, and you didn't have very much to wear at the time. Did you get into your spacesuits to wear to keep warm? Is that what you used?
If you use the spacesuits, even at that temperature, if you could not flow air, cooling air through the suits, you'd get very hot in there and perspire. And if you recall, we used one set of intake hoses in the limb system to attach that cartridge to. And the limb was only made for operations with two people. So there was only one set of hoses available. Rather than one person getting a suit and take advantage of that set of hoses, and we just decided not for anybody to get in a suit.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that the walls of the Lunar Module were not too much thicker than maybe a heavy-duty plastic garbage bag.
No, that's not true.
No?
No, it's aluminum structure, and it wasn't very thick because of the weight control requirements for to do the performance to land on the moon. But no, a lot of people say that, like it's thick foil or something. That's an exaggeration. No, it's not anywhere as strong as the command and service module, which has to survive the stress of a launch through the air, atmosphere, and obviously back through entry. So it's comparatively speaking, it's a delicate vehicle compared to the command and service module.
When you performed your slingshot around the moon, On your way back to the Earth, you had to perform a course correction.
Mission Control, who was tracking, realized we were actually the first maneuver they devised after we passed the moon, and that was the biggest maneuver we did of all. And the purpose was to speed us up. In essence, really, what it did was change the path back a little bit, and by doing so, shortened our return to entry by about 10 hours. And that was critical because that really got us sort of in alignment with all our supplies, our oxygen, water, electrical, in the landing craft. That, in fact, gave us some margin. The next day, we did two more mid-course corrections. Again, that was based purely on the ground tracking and figuring out we had, for some reason, strayed off a little bit. And so two more corrections were done to get us, you know, set right for entry.
Did any of your maneuvers or course corrections have to be done manually?
Two of them, the last two we did. The first one we did to get us in the right direction to go around the moon, and that very large maneuver I mentioned after we passed the moon by a couple hours, that was done fully automated through the computers. The next two maneuvers, which were very short maneuvers, were done manually, looking out the window, so to speak.
If these burns or course corrections were not performed properly, would you have skipped off the Earth's atmosphere and back out into space?
I can't tell you the errors they were looking at. There is a window that an angle of about 3 degrees. When you enter the Earth's air, you have to be within about a 3-degree angle. If you're deeper than that, you will burn up. And if you're shallower than that, you'll skip out and stay in orbit, in essence. So it is critical, but our navigation, mostly done, performed by the ground. Now, if the command module had been powered up, which it wasn't, it was dead, it had a navigation system in its computer. Of course, it was gone during this time. So we had no navigation on board, but ground tracking had really been used for all the missions, but the primary mid-course corrections done throughout the program. There was no reason the ground couldn't figure it out again. And they actually directed these mid-courses, and that, you know, worked, obviously.
After almost 4 days in the lunar module and very cold temperatures, you returned to the command module, which I got to believe was just as cold or colder.
It was colder because when we went through entry in the little capsule, and they got it on board the aircraft carrier and got to inspect it, the water tanks were frozen, even after entry. So, yeah, it was colder in there. That the Jack Swigert and I went in to do the power up, which was a totally new procedure. There really was no procedure to power up the command module in flight. It had never been meant to be powered up. It's never supposed to be powered down. So that was another challenge people on the ground, Mission Control and some system people, was they had to invent this power-up procedure. Another problem was we had no blank paper. So we had to, again, use what was left of backs and fronts of other checklists that were blank. And Jack Swigert actually wrote it down, and he very carefully numbered the pages. And so the whole read-up of that power-up procedure, which was quite lengthy, we kept on whatever blank paper we could find.
Now you're back in the command module. You ride back home. About 5 hours before re-entry, you jettisoned the service module. Is that correct?
I really don't remember the exact time, but it wasn't very long. Both the LEM and the service module. Everything was pushed late, including the power-up of the command module, because of that limited power in the three entry batteries. So if you started the power up too quick, you conceivably could run out of electric power and not be able to get, for instance, the parachutes out. So you had to have enough battery power to get through the entire entry sequence. And so, like I said, we were kind of pushed into a corner on getting a lot of that done.
You then jettisoned the lunar module, Aquarius.
Actually, we jettisoned the service module first and shot some pictures of it. In fact, you've probably seen them. And
yes, I have. Yeah.
After that, then we jettisoned the limb, sort of angled off a little bit, and so we wouldn't have trouble, a chance of coming back together during entry.
And upon reentry, normally communications are around 5 minutes, blackout communications, but I believe it was a little longer for you.
It was, which has never been explained. Actually, I think a whole, quite a bit longer, which had people on edge in mission control. We were not even aware of it, frankly. But scientifically, no one's ever been able to explain that.
What were your thoughts when you landed in the Pacific after that long journey?
When you splice down, you have a set of procedures still to go through. You have to save things. You have to get the get rid of the chutes. Again, you got a checklist, and you're going through the steps, getting that taken care of. At the same time, the divers, Navy divers, have gone in the water, and they're doing a similar thing outside to save the spacecraft to be able to open the hatch.
At any time during the mission, any part of the rescue mission, did you ever think about the odds of returning safely to the Earth?
I don't know how to compute odds. it was true of me testing airplanes and same way of approaching a flight like that. You have no guarantee you'll get back any before you even leave. When you leave, you have no guarantee. In fact, we normally prepared that way, and same way in fighter squadrons, you normally had a designee, in my case, a fellow named Jerry Carr that lived in the neighborhood. And actually, I would have gone back and landed on the moon on Apollo 19, had we flown 19. But Jerry, I had invited over to my house, and I went through all the insurance papers and stuff he would have to worry about should I not get back. So he was there to, you know, help out the family and the wife in that eventuality, which is pretty standard practice if you're in a fighter squadron.
As a kid, I remember watching the news and seeing all of you on the Iwo Jima. You all looked very thin and weak. I believe you had an infection.
I had a bladder infection. And it, you think of a spacecraft as being pristine or pure, but, you know, there's germs everywhere. Right now, you and I are breathing bacteria of some kind. And they're still on the spacecraft, and we got tired and weak, and I was, more tired and more weak. So one of them gravitated and went viral and got me this bladder infection.
It really wasn't until that time that I realized, as a kid watching this, that, you know, how dangerous the trip had been, and the crew of Apollo 13 and Mission Control basically made it look seamless. No other astronauts have traveled farther from the Earth and come back with or overcome so many difficulties. As I say, I believe it's NASA's most successful mission.
Well, I don't know about most successful, but it certainly showed dramatically and actually the process and system we had and the brain power we had in the program to be able to solve and work problems. And I guess Apollo 13 made that stand out more than any mission. We had problems on every mission. We almost aborted Apollo 14. And similarly, we almost aborted Apollo 16, except for a workaround in both cases. So it was Apollo 13 was not unique in having a problem. It had a particular problem that put us into territory we had never planned to be in. But other than that, like I said, we had a system. We had a lot of good people, smart people, knew the vehicles, knew the systems, and a methodology to work problems. That was the way most of our training was on that basis.
It was an incredible group effort, that's for sure. And Mr. Hayes, you're presently working on a very special project. I guess you've been working on it for some time at the Infinity Science Center.
Yes, I'm a vice chairman of a board, a not-for-profit board, That was challenged to raise enough money to build and then, as we are now, operate a Infinity Science Center. It's at Interstate 10, right off an exit as you come in, the first exit as you come into Mississippi. We're 8.5 million cars past that exit, and we're also partnered with NASA Stennis Space Center, which is just north of that exit, where they test a lot of rocket engines, where the Navy has the Meteorological Oceanography Command, and NOAA there maintains and operates all the worldwide weather buoys and a tsunami net over by Japan, that kind of thing. And at most universities in Mississippi have research institutes there. So anyway, the way it worked was NASA had acquired land next to the Mississippi State Visitor Center, and they deeded us, in essence, through a land use agreement, the land for 30 years. And we, the not-for-profit, had to go raise the money. We raised $30 million to build the facility, and now we're operating it in our second year.
Is there a website that people can go to find more information about?
Yes, the website is www.visitinfinity.com.
Mr. Hayes, it's been an honor to have you today with us on Cosmic Perspective to discuss your career, your involvement with the Infinity Science Center to inspire the next generation, and your experiences on NASA's most successful mission, Apollo 13. Thank you again for being with us.
You're very welcome. And if anybody from up your way is down on the Gulf Coast, maybe visiting New Orleans, about 40 minutes from New Orleans to Infinity.
Okay, I'd love to take a trip there someday myself.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. As command module pilot of Apollo 13, Fred Hayes mentioned in our interview, all of the Apollo missions to the moon had problems, and most came very close to being aborted. Apollo 11 had to be landed without the aid of computers by Neil Armstrong, with just a few seconds of fuel remaining. Apollo 12 was struck by lightning during launch, and Pete Conrad held off the abort long enough for Alan Bean to switch on the SCC to AUX circuit. Apollo 14's lunar module had an electrical malfunction as it descended to the surface. Apollo 16 had command module problems while the lunar module was preparing to land. Just to name a few of the many problems that occurred on the Apollo missions. In fact, Apollo 13 had less anomalies than any of the other Apollo missions, but of course the most challenging one. And as with all the other problems that occurred on these missions, everyone at NASA was trained, prepared, and dedicated to sending men to the moon and returning them safely to the Earth.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space. For we meet in an hour of change and challenge, in a decade of hope and fear, in an age of both knowledge and ignorance. The greater our knowledge increases, the greater our ignorance unfolds. For the eyes of the world now look into space, to the moon, and to the planets beyond, and we have vowed that we shall not see it governed by a hostile flag of conquest, but by a banner of freedom and peace. We have vowed that we shall not see space filled with weapons of mass destruction, but with instruments of knowledge and understanding. Many years ago, the great British explorer George Mallory, who was to die on Mount Everest, was asked, why did he want to climb it? He said, because it is there. Well, space is there, and we're going to climb it. And the moon and the planets are there, and new hopes for knowledge and peace are there. And therefore, as we set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which man has ever embarked. Thank you.
Cosmic Perspective Radio is an Andy Poneros production.